panel discussion. We're going to abbreviate it slightly so that we have time to take a few audience questions. We're going to do just two questions for the panelists today, and I'm going to turn it over to Dana Spindler from ICF, who's going to facilitate that for us. Thank you.
Thanks, Emma, and thanks for all the speakers for participating today. The first panel question that we have is, given the uncertainty about future climate and how that's frequently presented as a challenge that is a barrier to taking action to plan for climate change, what tactics have you used to overcome the uncertainty barrier to climate change? Are there examples of more traditional practice, such as economic uncertainty, that might offer lessons for planning for future climate in the face of uncertainty? We're hoping, Kara, maybe you can kick us off with an answer.
Sure. Sure. Thank you. Well, I think that there's quite a lot in military language, not that all of it can be adopted exactly as it's used in that setting, but there's a lot there around, you know, planning based on trend lines and the importance of actually not waiting for 100% conclusive evidence, because oftentimes then it's just quite simply too late to take the action that you might like to see. So that's definitely an area we've looked to. Also insurance, you know, just spending time looking at how insurance is marketed, I think is really important, because it's actually tapping that uncertainty as a reason to act and take precaution. The other thing, though, that you see quite a lot are groups really focusing heavily on the benefit side rather than really emphasizing the uncertainties that are still there, and really focusing on addressing needs that they know people have in the local community. So, for example, in Los Angeles, there's a whole effort to focus on cool roofs and moving into cool playgrounds and really making the Los Angeles basin much more livable in the face of climate impacts. So it's taking existing realities that people already are experiencing and focusing there on the place to start. So I think there's actually a lot of opportunity. And then, as I said, you know, earlier in my presentation, now to also just recognize that there is an emotional component of uncertainty, and none of us really like to spend that much time thinking about all of the kind of horrible things that might happen to ourselves and our family. And so to just, you know, trend carefully. And a lot of what that involves is not sort of telling people what the impacts to them are, but rather exploring that in peer groups, as was mentioned by the Climate Solutions University speakers.
Thank you. Cynthia, do you have a response to this question as well?
Yes, I think, first of all, defining the current climate risks, major hazards for each region in discussion, as we've heard over and over again. And then I think, and then from those current risks, then providing information on how those may risks, first of all, may be changing now, because, for example, in most regions of the country over the past 30 years, intense and heavy downpours are already increasing. So I think moving from identifying first the key hazards in each region, and then looking at how those are changing now, and then is the appropriate time to bring in the information about how those climate risks may change in the future. And I think what we've found is to be also upfront, be very clear. We don't know for sure if it's going to rain next Wednesday, and as we present the risks in the future, we always give a range, because we don't know exactly what the greenhouse gas emissions trajectory will be, and we don't know exactly how the climate system will respond. So being upfront, very clear, but still present a range. But I think to be sure to include that information.
Thank you. The next question will be directed towards Nancy and Gwen and JT. Jonathan, and we've spent the last hour talking about how to achieve buy-in for adaptation, and this is a very proactive approach. But oftentimes people are working on adaptation may face an uphill battle to overcome political or economic opposition. How have you been successful in overcoming that opposition? And if you choose to bypass opposition and denial, do you have any suggested methods to that, or recommendations to how to deal with climate deniers that show up to stakeholder meetings and such? Gwen and Nancy?
Gwen, I'll go ahead. This is Nancy. So we definitely have this issue among some of our rural communities, and the political opposition can be very well scripted. In many cases, we hear almost the same script in different parts of the country from the deniers. So, for example, we had a Colorado community that just finished its plan and needed to deal with local government officials and private landowners, but the denying factor was so strong, they had to completely shift tactics and move towards the agencies that were really willing to talk about climate change. So we just don't think it's worth it to come up against that opposition, but find the partners that do want to work together and just don't use the word climate change. That's working for us.
I think we have just a few minutes left. So JT, do you have a response to this as well?
Well, in situations like that, I've found using an analogy about fighting burglaries is a good one. If you were hit by repeated break-ins at your business or at your home, you'd immediately want to spend some money to get better locks on your doors or, buy a burglar alarm, get a guard, whatever. And you would be willing to spend some money. However, you really might not know why people are robbing you. In fact, there are many reasons why crime could be happening in your neighborhood. It could be lack of mental health services. It could be unemployment. It could be lack of youth opportunities. And if you took a position that you would spend nothing to protect your property from crime until someone could prove to you 100% why it was happening, that's sort of ridiculous. There are many reasons for crime, and what we say is that there are people out there that are carrying on debates about climate change, but we do not need to engage in that here. We're talking about protecting this community, and we believe that that's important, and we can't wait for these national and international debates to be settled before we take action. So I get a lot of head nods when I use that analogy in public.
Thank you. I'm sure we're getting head nods on the phone as well. So we just have a few minutes left, and we've received lots of questions. We're going to try and do a little rapid fire and answer at least a couple of them. The first one for Cynthia, we had the question, was the City Health Department included in the task force in New York City? And if not, what was the reason?
The answer is yes, actually, and it should be on there. They did. They came to every meeting, and we should add it onto that slide. And they have been very active in preparing, in particular, heat advisories, and especially working on the heat stress that we have now with our current climate and is projected to increase in the future.
Thank you.
Oh, let me just add one final thought on that, which is that I think also that the health departments in the communities is also a very, very often a very key, good place to engage with, because, again, that's a direct link to the community, and people do care about their health.
Thanks. And for Gwen and Nancy, do you have any recommendations on how to identify and activate local community champions?
Hi, this is Gwen. What we've learned is not a revelation, but it really boils down to relationships. and building relationships of trust across networks with sharing good information and providing a non-confrontational approach to adaptation planning and implementation. So a lot of it is that personal interaction and really listening, hearing what are other people's priorities. For example, in Cookeville, it was listening and understanding the mayor and the administration and understanding their desire for really positioning the community as being attractive to development and growth. Understanding that by listening helped provide a way for them to step up and be proactive in that way, which has served the community very well.
Thank you. And for JT, the COAST model is based on sea level rise projections or predictions. And how, with the analysis, is there a way that that could apply to a community that is not affected by sea level rise, say in Ohio, or lessons that you've learned that you would apply to such a city?
Well, the model works by taking an asset and compromising it to a certain height. So if you had an area with heavy rainfall incidents that had been flooding, you could use the model to look at potential damage from storms. And if you had some data or predictions on the increasing frequency of 10-inch rains in the area, and then if you did some stormwater improvements or drainage improvements, you could lessen that. The model could be used to look at rainfall events. So, I mean, right now, the most obvious use of the model is in adapting to sea level rise and storm surge. But it's been interesting that, that particularly with Kingston, a community that was almost 80 miles north of New York City, that even there, they're getting a hurricane damage enough to bring us in to work on this issue.
Great. Thank you.
Can I just add to that? I do think that it's really important that we don't ignore the potential for inland flooding from these intense events. This is happening already more frequently. This is documented. And so inland, there's still flooding issues that this kind of analysis can and should be carried out.
Thank you. So we're hitting 11:30, the end of our time now, and there are many more questions. We will send those out to participants. We'll get responses from the speakers and send those out to participants, and I'm going to hand it over to Emma from the APA to close the session. Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you, Dana. Thank you, Wendy, for helping facilitate today, and thank you to all of our speakers for all the presentations. We greatly appreciate you sharing your time and your expertise with us, and I think you hit on many key points and themes that we will hope to build upon in our next webcast. As we mentioned previously, in April, we'll be covering the topic of uncertainty in decision-making in more detail. And then lastly, in May, we'll get to the topic of funding and building financial strategies for adaptation. So we hope folks will sign up for the newsletter and get those updates on registration when they are available. So thank you again to our speakers, and we will make all of the files and recordings and unanswered questions available on our website after the call, so please check out that as well. And thank you to all the participants today for sharing your insights with the poll questions, and I encourage everyone to, as they close out today, fill out the optional feedback. That is certainly how we develop series like this and other resources, and your information is really valuable for us to be able to develop resources to meet your needs. So thanks again, and I encourage folks to participate in our subsequent webcast. And with that, I think we will close out for today. So thank you.
This concludes today's conference. You may now disconnect.